Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Companion. This is the 293rd day of the year of 6013 Anno Lumine. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. I couldn't really get through the week without relying more on your very intense advice. I hope the program again is a bit informative, a bit entertaining and engaging for people who are able to sit back and enjoy and my glass of their favorite Kool-Aid and think of things in a more contemplative frame of mind just for a little while. I know that the year has been seems to be going past very quickly. It's always that interesting sense of the passage of time. It's really not time that's passing, is it? It's our perception that changes. So curious that we continue to use those types of terms of relative reference that are pretty much inaccurate. The science hasn't slowed down. I want to talk to you a bit today about some of that, the perception. I thought that today's topic was kind of interesting, and I just wanted to look over the edge of the horizon just a little bit further to 2017. We're going to be experiencing 300 years of that continuity of structured, the declaration of structured Masonic organization around St. John's Day, I think it was. It's an interesting date. And I hope that as we approach it, we can put a bit of, you may find some value in putting a bit of thought in front of it. On that day, I think collectively we can pause and reflect on things that connect us to events out of mind. History records some pieces of it, but out of mind, nobody's alive today that was alive then. Each dedicated Freemason, whether an accomplished apprentice, student of the arts or sciences, or a man who feels he is more than himself because he's a member of our fraternity, candidly, it doesn't really matter. We know the goal of enlightenment has flickered, as it always has. It doesn't shine on us as a beam. We have these beautiful analogies and metaphors and myths and inspirations and philosophies, but it is it's not for the simple-minded, And yet it's not necessary that we take this task and make it more complicated than it already is. So I ask, it crossed my mind, and I'd like your help with this. Have, with rare exception, creating an atmosphere of learning and complication is a task that is yet lying before us. The compression of history makes it seem like Freemasonry has been a steady association of brilliant thinkers, as if they are our contemporaries. By comparison, we deal with life day by day by day. We don't have that compendium in our mind, that moving forward notion of the brilliance around us within Freemasonry. Freemasonry, I think, is reflections. And to understand those reflections, we have to sort out the distortion from what's real. But it is all perception. I may never be able to lead you in a discussion or to lead you, join you in a discussion of what's real or not. I have my mind, the brain makes impressions of the world around us. It's better, I think, to understand that than to walk around with a sort of a simplistic notion that the ancients once had, that superstition was the best explanation for some of the phenomena around. Even today, as we look at string theory, it is the best explanation for the facts as we know them today. But there's always that notion that, you know, what lies before us could change those beliefs and that understanding. And that I refer to as hope. So no, we don't live a lie unless you're a little bit simple-minded about the way that you see the world. But the compression does make it seem like, you know, we've gathered, we've accumulated some talent within the order over 300 years and beyond that. And yeah, I'm one of those people that questions, as some do, whether, you know, question some of the assumptions that are made about Freemasonry in order to put things into context, not so much to prove right from wrong. I don't know that. I'll leave that to people like you and the Creator. Our strength, I think, is the influence of thought, decision, conscience, and expression. Can we influence the way we go about, can we influence the communities that we live in? Well, in very subtle ways that need to be satisfying. Like when you taste that fresh berry or that bit of escargot. You know, you taste just a little bit of it. It's wonderful. Those little savory moments or those little sort of taste surprises. I think those are subtleties. And it's an individual and personal experience. And I think we bring that to the table. We bring that to our lives. We bring that to our world in a frame of continuous awareness. I think the goal for us is to strive for awareness, and then it's not just achieving it once, but to continue in that frame of mind. Accepting, reasoning, thinking laterally, thinking broadly. We struggle to begin to understand, I would think, what conscience is. Yeah, I live in a world where a lot of people think of their creator as Santa Claus. If I do something, an act of contrition, I get something in return. That's it? That's all we've got? I get blessings, I get gifts from the Creator, and all of this complexity around me is reduced to that ego. I find that a shame if that's the way men think. I find that a shame to limit. But who am I to say that I'm right and somebody else doesn't have the right answer? Perhaps the Creator is Santa Claus. And I'm getting it all wrong. But it's not enough for us to think about these things, dwell on them, but to express them in some way. When you read a newspaper, I doubt your mind travels off the page to the historic processes that brought about freedom of the press. That's a chewy little mouthful, isn't it? From the production of print to the capacity to have comment uncensored. Man, is that an interesting statement to make in the 21st century with the release of documents that show that some of the so-called carriers of the high standards of democracy are little more than what we hoped they would never be. Totalitarian, authoritarian. A bit daunting, a bit frightening. One day soon, I think, we'll be retested. Did our ancestors fight and sacrifice for freedoms that we today are prepared to renegotiate and give away? Somehow, I don't think so. I don't look forward to that. I hope that day never comes. And maybe it's just the tragedy of my own sense of history that I have this sense that we need to figure out a better way of going about our business than to be searching into the privacy and freedom of good people. The whole world is not full of terrorists. Although we've seemed to be consumed by cowboys and the sense that this marginal group, this fringe group of zealots, that causes, it always has caused conflict or are predominant. Well, they're not. They're not. It's all riffraff. It's important that we prevail. And we look for the honesty in the heart of the man. 300 years of history has seemingly made us sheepish about the notion of great ideas. The people and the men who developed great ideas at the time weren't sitting in committee waiting for permission. My goodness, can you imagine? We want consensus about this novel bit of engineering, this art that pushes the envelope into something that's hard for people to understand. Unless we have that consensus of committee, it invalidates what we're doing. Rather sad, isn't it? No, the creativity continues on. That's why I think we need to be able to look perhaps more broadly at what Freemasonry is about. It's not about stifling creativity, nor is it about introducing those creativity. It's the genius comes from within. That entered apprentice that is far superior to his master. And of course, you've heard me talk time and time again about the superlatives of the young student, the prodigy, who has great capacity and great talent to amaze and to mesmerize the rest of us. It's a wonderful world that we live in. We have those opportunities around us all the time. Great ideas will come in spite of us, in spite of the sense of committee and bureaucracy. And I want to talk to you, and I need your advice here, brother. If James Anderson or Elias Ashmole or Christopher Wren were amongst us today, I dare say they would be suffocated in a faceless Masonic bureaucracy that did not exist in their day. This isn't deliberate. This isn't posturing. Well, okay, you're saying, was Wren a Freemason? Okay. And you could say, was James Anderson a Mason? Well, okay, so I'll leave that to the gentlemen of the jury out there, you thinkers. But you get the idea. I'm talking about some people that whose names are significant. I dare say those ideas would have a hard time as they're presented. You think there wasn't a lot of structure and a lot of rules to govern how people went about doing their business. But the mountain was very, very steep. If I was fortunate enough to live in Venice and Florence and have the support of a patron like the Medici and could convince them that my ideas had some merit, then I would do well. But how many other geniuses, how many other brilliant minds simply did not have the means to achieve a demonstration of their ideas? Couldn't build the models, didn't have time to support themselves while they did the research. Let's just say all that we missed was one. And let's just presume that it was the one that would have made a huge difference. And so we can promise ourselves as we move forward into the future that we'll try not to let that happen. That's an absolute, isn't it? But we need to be able to try. Always keep our minds open. As we prepare our thoughts for 2017, we continue to adapt, strengthened by a natural curiosity. When we look up from our workbench to share findings, we owe it to ourselves and our ancients to do so with dignity, sophistication, and humiliation. Whether we see it or not, the truth is within us. Freemasonry is the laboratory. Let alchemy help you and me explore the mysteries, for goodness sake. I need your advice once again. Freemasonry seems to be the structure. And I think inside the order, I've noticed that we find that there are small groups where there's persuasive personalities with persuasive ideas. I don't mean the bombastic or the obsequious. Those are people that get under my skin like they do for most of us. Say it loud. If you've got a weak idea, say it with some temper, or say it in earnest, or say it with a weak personality where you can't control your emotions, just to cover up the weakness of your argument, the feebleness of your thinking. Yeah, I'm too old for that stuff. I think the order where we find these pockets of where the ideas are good and they're sound, it shouldn't necessarily suggest to us that the same persuasion should, go viral, as the kids say today, go viral across the jurisdiction. I think what it points out to us is this capacity for us to have many different types of cells where there are some very clever things going on. All expressions on central theme. If I was to give you a shipload of instruments and say, here, have at it, we might hear some playing calypso, some playing classical, some playing jazz, some playing country, some playing blues, some playing new world, new age. All expressions of creativity, forms of creativity. That kind of diversity, I think, is the strength and health of Freemasonry. What I think Freemasonry brings, like a Grand Lodge, is the structure, the principles in which we agree collectively, that provides the framework for a particular form of thought. I think the leaders in our Grand Lodge come around and remind us of the principles. They don't say You know that when you listen to our grand masters successively, they're not people that are going to tell. They're people that are leading and teaching. They comment, they lament, they handle the pressures for us of a very, very large, complicated organization. But they're there at a moment's notice to put their hand on our shoulder and encourage us to do our best. Always. Always. Now, I think it's wrong when we give somebody credit for a skill that they don't have. Any right-minded person would. But that's not what interferes with the brilliance in developing these persuasive cells and ideas. I think it's limiting if we think that a brilliant idea in one area needs to be similarly expressed in another area. I think it's important to embrace the diversification. And I think it's more accurate to think of Freemasonry in that way. You know, I've spoken with you and asked your advice about this idea of conformity. Well, conformity isn't like, you know, we're all singing the same note at the same time. If you studied a little bit about the philosophy of our craft, it has something to do with single-mindedness, where we can become, where we can join like-minded. Well, I think we do. And we look around and see all kinds of variations on that like-mindedness. Living a better life. Well, for some, it's different than for others. Studying Freemasonry. Well, there's some things that I think are just wacky. And those folks probably think that the way I approach it is a bit wacky too. That's perfectly fine. Perhaps I am. There's the fascinating bits. The mystery schools, the alchemists. Where we walk through the veils, where we walk in the shadows, where we think beyond what's polite and appropriate. Where things become unsettling and we're pushed outside our comfort zone. For some of us, that's an important step, a test. And then we sit back and examine. It's not like we're jumping up and down. We're not children. But we sit back and examine the effect of going through these trials. What effect has it had on me as a person? How would I even know? Would I have been any different if I never had those experiences? I have no way of knowing that. So I speculate. Freemasonry is the expression of the principles. And inside that body, that framework, we exist. We exist. And we have limits, of course. But when you look at the overall function, it's like we have this enormous complementarity of function. Sort of like the organs in a body. We don't have one organ. We have different systems interrelated that allow the overall function to occur, life to occur. Some parts of it we understand better than other parts. Is there one part that is more predominant? Well, you know, nobody's come up with a better package yet. Now, there may be different and better ways of going about the arts and sciences, but I haven't found it yet. I'm sure that it exists out there, but I haven't seen it. But for me to ever suggest that this is the bee's knees, the pinnacle, I think that's the day when I should take a demit. And I've lost all sense of compassion and sense of humanity. The struggle for us is the same as the struggle for all people. Tell me what you think. Let me know. Does that make some sense?
I hope so.
I truly hope so. I just think we spend a lot of energy trying to find some sense of uniformity that really doesn't exist. Or in a sense, it already exists. Uniformity occurs during our initiation. When we hear the values, you hear our motto, Aude Vide Tace. There's uniformity. We are all in this continuous lineup at the Oracle of Delphi, and we have the question to ask her. And her answer may not make sense to us, but that's it. You've got your answers. Step aside. Turn for the next man. So we walk through the portal of an initiation process without really understanding what it is that we've gone through, probing only in as much depth as we have a capability. Not everybody has the same intellectual capability or interest, curiosity. For some, it's still, you know, for some men, they still can't quite grasp the sense that we assume a different character when we're in our lodge. You'll see them giggle or carry on, chatter away as if they're somewhere else. As we get a little older, I find it harder to accept that it's just naivety and we should wait and ask, has the fellow been trained? So we can offset that. Say, well, it's not really his responsibility. It's his mentors or his lack of mentors. Well, sorry. We're supposed to be a mature age. Vide. Watch. Pay attention. Get your head out of the sand. Take a look at what's going on. There's always, I think, and I hope, opportunities to strengthen the atmosphere for learning. Yeah, I know that the taxil, you know, we still have some simple-minded fellows walking around talking about all of the embarrassments that have ever accumulated in Freemasonry. And they seem to have this, you know, I don't know, they have this sense that this is the way it's always been, and they need to bring it up when somebody is a candidate at the door of a lodge. Never quite could figure that one out. I understand it. But why would anybody want to air their laundry in a first meeting? It's an embarrassment. But life will go on with or without that type of thing, won't it? And I'm sure those kind of comments serve a useful purpose for the rest of us. I can point out and feel quite scandalized and say, oh my goodness, look at that. That's just shameful. I wonder if I begin to sound like my grandfather. Look at that. Except you probably would be a lot more discreet about it. You'd only talk about that type of thing with his close friends. Sort of like what I'm doing right now with you. Anyway, this is an interesting day. Let's see what we've got from Rudyard Kipling. Words are, of course, the most powerful drug used by mankind. I never made a mistake in my life, at least never one that I couldn't explain away afterwards. Man. If history were taught in the form of stories, it would never be forgotten. Oh, are we talking about history now or Hiram? The secrets are kind of curious, aren't they? They take us to the secret of the experience that you have. You know, becoming a Freemason doesn't really make us, it doesn't really in and of itself educate. It's like walking through the doors of a university or a college. A place of higher learning, or a place where some serious thinking goes on. For some, that's a church or synagogue or mosque. Something serious is happening here, something thoughtful. It doesn't mean we... It means a lot. It means that we conduct ourselves with a certain decorum, a respect. Remember, judge me as harshly as you can, because all I ever expect from you is the sophistication and humility, the dignity of an honorable man, of a man of larger character, the bigger man. That's all I expect. And you should expect at least as much and more from me. It's a bit disappointing when I think about it. It's a bit daunting. How could I ever go about functioning like that? How could I possibly? Well, you set yourself your own challenges, don't you? What happens if we read a little bit today? You know, get into a little more reading. I don't mean read like it's boring, but get on with a little bit more about how to live a good life. Let's see if I can I'm feeling a little bit befumbled here. I just need a little bit of a A man's walking through the recreation ground of his local park when he notices a huge fight in full fury on the football pitch as he's passing. "What's going on?" he asks a spectator watching from the sidelines. The other replies, "It's a match between the Masons and the Knights of Columbus." "What's the score?" asks the first man. "I don't know. It's a secret." Ah, oh, dear. I know. It's just... you know, I should be able to do better than that, huh? A doctor and a plumber in the same lodge. On Sunday morning, the doctor wakes up to find his toilet blocked, so he rings the plumber. "But I don't work on Sundays. Can't it wait until tomorrow?" The doctor said, "I do not like working Sundays either, but if you were in trouble and felt unwell, brother, I would come right around to see you." "Okay," says the plumber and goes around to the doctor. He goes upstairs and looks at the toilet, takes two aspens from his pocket and throws them down the bowl. "There, if it's no better tomorrow, give me a ring and I'll be your call around." Here's me, a tired old mason, his hair was gray, came to the gates of heaven one day. When asked what on earth he had done the most, he said he had replied to the visitor's toast. St. Peter said as he tolled the bell, "Come inside, my brethren. You've had enough of hell." That's a good one. No, come on. There's a man walking down the street at 1 in the morning, and he's very, very drunk. He's in his cups, or as I like to think of it, he's pixelated. The policeman stops him and asks, "Where are you going in that condition?" "Man, I'm on my way to lecture in Freemasonry." "Officer, where can you possibly get a lecture in Freemasonry at this time of night?" "From my wife when I get home." that was good. What do you say? Anyway, sorry. I'm still getting over a little bit of a cold here, I guess. So I'm in a weakened state of mind, which at the best of times is the state of mind that I seem to be in most of all. put your feet up and you think about our friend William Slesley, Wilmhurst, and Willie, and and his lament, his concern that there was a drift, that the purest principles of Freemasonry weren't being expressed or taught. Well, I don't think it's ever been any different. That's the risk. That's the risk. That's the price we pay when we put out some noble ideas. We are cultivating this enriched garden, but we can't tell when we plant each. We plant this seed inside. It's the mind of a man. We can't tell. We've never seen it nurtured. We don't know what it's capable of doing or how big it'll go or when or if. But we have to, you know, step aside from that sense of, I think it's helpful to step aside from that sense of disappointment. But how do you really do that? You're always yearning and hoping, well, this next fella coming around the corner, you know, he'll be everything that I would expect a Freemason to be. That's a fairly weighty, that's a fairly chewy responsibility that we're placing on ourselves and our new Masons. So let's at least find that doing that is a vehicle for us to learn to be generous, thoughtful in spirit. I think I'm going to try and write up a list of. Do you think it's so overboard if I write up a list of readings that I think would be important? You know, Cervantes and some Marlowe and maybe even some William Wordsworth. I think that might be kind of interesting. Give us something a little more useful to talk about than these Masonic subjects all the time. My goodness, you know, we're going to get tired of all of that quite quickly. Now, we've got a lot of things happening, you know. I haven't joined you since I came back from Timmins for the consecration of a new lodge room at Porcupine 501. What truly warm hospitality, wonderful hosts, sincere, genuinely good fellows, absolute pleasure. Truly generous, kind, thoughtful. It's like being with you. Well, your kind has found a great place around Timmins and Porcupine, and it's they do things their own way and for their own reasons. They have a strong, I think, strong sense of community and a connection with us. It's wonderful. It really is. A wretched soul bruised with adversity, we bid be quiet when we hear it cry. But were we burdened with like weight of pain, as much or more we should ourselves complain. That's Shakespeare. Huh? William, now we've got the big fuss up about whether he ever wrote anything, and whether it was a sort of a conspiracy. Great stuff, great stuff. Here's a little pearl from him. Assume a virtue if you have it not. You'd be the most scurrilous, backbiting, narrow-minded son of a gun in the world. But if you think that it's a virtue for you to be honest, forthright, and kind, assume it, even though in your black heart you're not. Fake it, and the rest of us won't know. We won't be any worse off for it. Be great in act as you have been in thought. How many times do we build great things in our minds? He's also a fellow that said action is eloquence. Just what one man's action is. My action at this age, at this point, where I'm just trying to recover some health, is different than when I was 10 years younger and 20 years younger and the foolishness of 30 years, or was it more, 40? Where I still have those anxiety attacks of thinking about the things that I've done that could have had some very dire consequence. I think cautious risk is the way you live a life and survive. I feel within me a peace above all earthly dignities, a still and quiet conscience. Let me embrace that kind of comment with you today. So can we talk a little bit? I hope so. I want to talk about, we talked about Montaigne, you know, the French guy who was 15th century, 16th century guy. He's talking about how to live. He's saying really the first point of being able to live is to be born. And I think you think about it, there's a guy that's saying if you're not born, you're not living. How to live, read a lot, forget most of what we read, and be slow-witted. there's a bit of a different type of comment. The close grammatical study of Cicero and Horace almost killed Montaigne's interest in literature before it was born. For some of the teachers at the school helped keep it going, mainly by not taking more entertaining books out of the boy's hands when they caught him reading them, and perhaps even by slipping a few more his way, doing this so discreetly that he could enjoy reading them without ceasing to feel like a rebel. Remember, this is a boy that wasn't allowed to speak the language. He was taught in Latin until, 11 or 12 years old. And if you know, I'm not a Latin scholar, but what that language does is, for me, it takes away nuance, and it sort of there's an honesty to the language, a purity, like the ideas are bound together with a clarity, even then, you know, some clarity, it's with clarity. And in English, the English that I know, I can sort of build the idea gradually. It's like when you see those beautiful watercolors when they begin to blend and mix together, and all of a sudden it's something in front of you that was quite unexpected. Well, that to me is English. Man, it's quite an interesting phenomena. In Latin, I think, has that clarity, you know, that honesty that I've heard some people talk about in terms of the music of Thelonious Monk. He's not fishing for the note. He hits the note. A Pavarotti, when you listen to him sing, he wasn't searching for the note like a little warbler. He plucked it. He selected it. That what a gift, what an instrument. One unsuitable text which Montaigne discovered for himself at the age of 7 or 8 and which changed his life, 7 or 8, was Ovid's Metamorphoses. This tumbling cornucopia of stories about miraculous transformations among ancient gods and mortals was the closest thing the Renaissance had to a compendium of fairy tales. As full of horrors and delights as a Grimm or Andersen, and quite unlike the texts of the schoolroom, it was the sort of thing an imaginative 16th century boy could read with eyes rounded and fingers white-knuckled from gripping the covers too tightly. In Ovid, people change. They turn into trees and animals, stars, bodies of water, or disembodied voices. They alter sex. They become werewolves. A woman called Scylla enters a poisonous pool and sees each of her limbs turn into a dog-like monster from which she cannot pull away because the monsters are also her. The hunter Actaeon is changed into a stag and his own hunting dogs chase him down. Icarus flies so high that the sun burns him. A king and queen turn into two mountains. The nymph Semicus plunges herself into the pool where the beautiful Hermaphroditus is bathing and wraps herself around him like a squid holding fast to its prey until her flesh melts into his and they two become one person, half male, half female. Once a taste of this sort of thing had started him off, Montaigne galloped through other books similarly full of good stories. Virgil's Aeneid, then Terence, Plautus, and various modern Italian comedies, he learned defiance of school policy to associate reading with excitement. This was the one positive thing to come out of his time there. But, as Montaigne added, for all of that, it was still school. You see, school was something serious. The atmosphere. Many of his early discoveries remained lifelong loves. Although the initial thrill of the Metamorphos wore off, he filled the essays with stories from it, you know, the essays that he wrote, and emulated Ovid's style of slipping from one topic to the next without introduction or apparent order. Virgil continued to be a favorite, too, though the mature Montaigne was cheeky enough to suggest that some passages in the Aeneid might have been brushed up a little. Because he liked to know what people really did rather than what somebody imagined they did, Montaigne's preference soon shifted from poets to historians and biographers. It was in real-life stories, he said, that you encountered human nature in all its complexity. You learned the diversity and truth of man as well as the variety of the ways he is put together and the accidents that threaten him. Among historians, he liked Tacitus best. Oh, yeah. I can't say I like Tacitus best, but good read. Try that out. Tacitus. He loved how Tacitus treated public events from the point of view of private behavior and inclinations, and was struck by the historian's fortune in living through a strange and extreme period, just as Montaigne himself had done. Indeed, he wrote of Tacitus, "You would often say that it is us he is describing." Fascinating. Fascinating. Turning to biographers, Montaigne liked those who went beyond the external events of a life and tried to reconstruct a person's inner world from the evidence. No one excelled in this more than his favorite writer of all, the Greek biographer Plutarch, who lived from around AD 46 to around 120. And he's getting on, 60 years, 80, and whose vast lives presented narratives of notable Greeks and Romans in themed pairs. Plutarch was to Montaigne what Montaigne was to many late readers, a model to follow and a treasure chest of ideas, quotations, and anecdotes to plunder. He is so universal and so full that on all occasions, and however eccentric the subject you have taken up, he makes his way into your work. The truth of this last part is undeniable. Several sections of the essays are paste-ins from Plutarch, left almost unchanged. You know, when you just find the idea and you think, nobody could express, I couldn't possibly improve on this. Fantastic. Montaigne, the slow and forgetful. Remember, he's saying how to live well, read a lot, forget most of what you read, and be slow-witted. In truth, he did work hard sometimes, but only when he thought the labor was worthwhile. Annotations in Montaigne's hand survive in a few books from his collection, notably a copy of Lucretius on the Nature of Things, clearly a text that merited close attention. This is exactly the kind of book, idiosyncratic and intellectually adventurous, that you would expect Montaigne to want to take such trouble over. Whenever Montaigne did exert himself to flick through a book according to him, he promptly forgot almost everything he had read. Memory is a wonderfully useful tool, and without it, judgment does its work with difficulty, he wrote, before adding, "It is entirely lacking in me." I don't know if it's entirely lacking. I wasted time, and now doth time waste me. He admitted that it is a nuisance. It is annoying to lose his most interesting ideas simply because they came to him while he was out riding and had no paper on which to write them down. It would have been nice to remember more of his dreams, too. As he wrote, quoting Terence,
I'm full of cracks and leak out on all sides.
Montaigne often sprang to the defense of the mnemonically challenged. He felt indignation and personal resentment from reading. Mnemonics, you know, sort of those memory, little memory prompts?
Yeah.
For example, about Lincests. Is this how you say it? Help me. Lyncestes. Who was obliged to give a speech of defense to a whole army after having been accused of conspiring against Alexander the Great.
Oh, there you go.
Take that, top that one up at Toastmasters. Whoa. Lincestus memorized an oration, but when he tried to deliver it, he only got a few words out before he became confused and forgetting the rest. While he stammered and hedged, a nearby group of soldiers lost patience and ran him through with their pikes. They thought his inability to speak proved his guilt. "That certainly was good reasoning," exclaimed Montaigne. "It proved only that under stress an overburdened memory is likely to take fright at its load like a panicky horse and dump the lot." Been there, done that. If it is this be a sin to covet honor, I am the most offending soul. Even if one's life was not at stake, learning a speech by heart was not necessarily a good idea. Spontaneous talk was usually more enjoyable to listen to. When Montaigne himself had to speak in public, he tried to be nonchalant and used unstudied and unpremeditated gestures, as if they arose from the immediate occasion. He particularly avoided announcing a sequence of numbered points. "I will now discuss 6 possible approaches," because it was both boring and risky. Amen, Montaigne. Pal, nothing is more tedious than having somebody read a report. Just hand me the page, I can read it myself. Oh, painful. Absolutely painful. Sometimes the very significance or interest of a piece of information. You know, I was listening to the physicist Susskind. Is it David? Wonderful. No, it's not David, is it? Malcolm Susskind. Just speaking off the top, I don't think it was the top of his head, spontaneously, it was just amazing to watch how fluidly he could express the ideas. I think that's how we make them accessible. All this knowledge we store in books that we can read. I can take this piece of time past with me. I can walk across the room with it. I can close the cover at my convenience, and I can open it up when it's stimulated and receptive to the learning. But I don't know that makes it necessarily accessible to other people. Others around us learn in many different ways. And I think we need to be very tolerant of that. Some, I like to think, are contemplative, and I think that's what the draw of Freemasonry is. Contemplation within the mind, within the human mind, singular. But we can become stimulated if I sit and listen to you and your thoughts. Then that stimulates my learning and the depth of my, and the clarity of my thinking. It's always easier to criticize somebody else's thinking and work. And I think that's the whole point of it. It's like walking into looking at a blank sheet of paper and saying, "Now design me a beautiful structure." Well, that's altogether different a task than saying, "Here's the structure we have. Give me some ideas about how we can improve on it." Well, I think Freemasonry, you start with the latter. I think when we're initiated, we go to the former. You're a blank sheet. Now we're going to rebuild you. Well, that's quite unsettling. And for some men, they can't get over that, particularly if they have that sense of insecurity about them. "I'm not that great to start with. I'm sure as hell not giving up what I got." Freemasonry comes along and says, "Hey, none of us are that great when we're starting. This is your rebirth. You come from nothing. You're wide open to new ideas." Now, is this reinventing ourselves? Maybe I still, you know, I'm beating this drum lately about adaptation.
Our order
is very, I think, organic, very human. And I think we constantly adapt, constantly, without necessarily thinking that we can predict. We adapt. And something that I'll be writing about in a little while is how we explore our future. How we explore it, always at the edge. In time, we hate that which we often fear. I don't know if I hate time yet. I just find that the hourglass seems to be running a little faster than I like it. I'd like it to go I have this sense I'd like it to go a little slower, but then I'm impatient about what tomorrow's going to bring. And to that one, our remedies often ourselves do lie. Yeah, I think sometimes the very significance or interesting of a piece drove it out of his mind. You know, once he found something very, very clever, that would just make it, he deposited it. And we know now that all this information is stored there. The task is around retrieval. How do we find it? How do we go get it when we want it? Well, maybe the last, you think about it, we're searching the universe out there. We're searching the oceans. We've searched the mountains and the jungles. Now we're just seem to be searching the human mind and the brain. And that, I think, in there, we're searching for notions of imagination, creativity, personality, soul. I think this is a journey that's going to be most rewarding. And one of those where I think it's the experience of the travel rather than the end result that's going to be so fascinating. Let me know. 100 years from now, come back and just let me know. You know, give me your thoughts on that. Remember, I just love this. This is Shakespeare on honesty. Though I am not naturally honest, I am so sometimes by chance. You know, you just get too tired to just continuously deceive. And then you look in the mirror and wonder who amongst us truly reveals his nature. Which lie do you tolerate, the one you tell yourself or the one you tell other people? I don't know. Freemasonry, the Masonic belief shrouds us with some protection, I think. You're not alone. The doubts that you have are the doubts of an honest man. They're necessary. I wondered how do we talk to somebody about that? Why knowing ourselves is so important. You know thyself. Whence come we? I don't like that old language, you know, to tell you the truth, but just because it's me, it's all about me. But why is that? Even now, if you ask me, why is that question so important? Well, I know it is without understanding that it is. And I know that over the course of my life, it will be an important answer, but I don't understand why it will be an important answer. Sounds, I remember when I first, the idea first struck me, and I had no idea, no real notion, you know, I didn't have context. Couldn't understand it. Now you see me many, many years later simply trying to put it into a context through your eyes or somebody else's eyes that will help me to understand. That's the work, I think, where we pass on and make these ideas accessible to other people. We call it mentoring. I call it friendship. I call it trust. The depths of trust are within Freemasonry, and there to be, you know, it's not something that's given away, something that's earned, just like respect. It's like the expectations I have of you. I expect what? Dignity and sophistication, But that's what I try to look for in you, in my brethren. The shortcoming, the slight, the awkward comment, well, we all do things to put distance between ourselves and other people. But as a Freemason, I'm also adds an insidious little craft we're part of. We look for the genuineness, the sincerity, the fidelity in a man. And by golly, if you know, if you open your eyes and start to look for it, it's there. It's there. Maybe it's in the, you know, the unwashed hands. I still remember, you know, when I gripped my father's hand, it just seems so, it was the hand of a tradesman, very powerful, and it makes me, mine seem sort of awkward by comparison. And I shake hands with, you know, those fellows that have to put that unique little dominant twist on things. And I'm always thinking, you know, you don't have to be so insecure. That's the way I think. It's like the fellow walking around with the muscle shirt on and a pit bull. Really that insecure? I know. He's out there to impress. And I'm impressed. But there you have it. What do I know? But Montaigne's admission of such failings in his memory was a direct challenge to the Renaissance idea of oratory and rhetoric, which held that being able to think well was the same as being able to speak well. And being able to speak well depended upon remembering your flow of argument together with sparkling quotations and examples to adorn it. Devotees of the art of memory, or ars memoriae, learned techniques for stringing together hours' worth of rhetoric, and even developed these techniques into a whole program of philosophical self-improvement. This had no appeal for Montaigne. From the start, you know, you sort of think, you'd be an interesting guy. Sit down, have a bite to eat, glass of wine. It'd be a really interesting conversation. It's not, you know, maybe he's just, he is writing about it and saying, well, this is my mind, I'm greater than himself. But you think, yeah, I'm not into that. I don't want to spend hours listening to somebody self-improvement. From the start, some readers have refused to believe that his memory really could be as bad as he claimed. This irritated him so much that he complained about it in his essays. But doubters continued to point out that, for example, he seemed to have no difficulty remembering quotations from his readings. So many appear in his essays, not least the one about feeling like a leaking pot. Either he was less leaky than he claimed, or he was less lazy. For if he did not remember the quotations, he must have written them down. Some people became positively angry about this. One near contemporary of his, the poet Dominique Baudier, said that Montaigne's lamentation about his memory drove him to nausea and laughter, an extreme reaction. The 17th century philosopher Malebranche felt Montaigne was lying to him, a serious charge against a writer who always made much of his honesty. It was a charge that had something to it. Montaigne surely did remember more than he let on. It is not unusual to feel let down by one's memory. This is part of the imperfect human condition. An undisciplined memory is also one that one might expect from Montaigne's easygoing upbringing and his dislike of forcing himself in anything. You know, it's maybe he is doing what some of us have done. You know, you just lower don't have people build up their expectations of you so they just avoids disappointment further down the road. Don't be so blatant about aiming high. I just can't handle the whining and complaining when things really screw up. Oh man. His apparent modesty on this subject can also be translated into a subtle claim of virtues which he thought more important. One of these, ironically, was honesty. As the old saying had it, bad memories make bad liars. If Montaigne was too forgetful to keep stories straight in his head, he had to tell the truth. Also, his lack of memory kept his speeches brief and his anecdotes concise. Since he could not remember long ones, then it enabled him to exercise good judgment.
People with good memories have cluttered minds, but his mind was so blissfully empty that nothing could get in the way of common sense. That's where it is. Finally, he easily forgot any slight... I'm not sure I agree with that, cluttered mind. And finally, he easily forgot any slight inflicted on him by others and therefore bore few resentments. In short, he presented himself as floating through the world in a blanket of benevolent vacancy. Where Montaigne's memory did seem to work well, if he wanted it to, was in reconstructing personal experiences, such as the riding accident. Instead of resolving them into neat, superficial anecdotes, he could recover feelings from the inside, not perfectly, because the Heraclitean stream kept carrying him away, but very closely. The 19th century psychologist Dugald Stewart speculated that Montaigne's lack of control of his memory made him better at such tasks. Montaigne was attuned to the kind of involuntary memory that would one day fascinate Proust, whose blast from the past that interrupt unexpectedly into the present, perhaps in response to a long-forgotten taste or smell. Such moments seem possible only if they are surrounded by an ocean of forgetfulness, as well as a suitable mood and sufficient leisure. There. You have to be in a mood for it, don't you? When you join me, I always hope, gee, I really do, that you're in the mood for this type of conversation. It's not something that is suitable all the time. You have to admit this would drive anybody to distraction. But when you're in the mood, it just seems to fit. It feels right. It's where I think I probe for your ideas. Virtue and genuine graces in themselves speak what no words can utter. It's attitude, isn't it? Attitude. Always that attitude. You have it. I'm just sliding into... I haven't talked to you about Andrew Hammer for a little while, have I? Andrew is an interesting guy, but I think, he is... perhaps more to the Latin thinker of Freemasonry. There is a way and a way of observance that he likes. But here's a man that's persuasive. And he has some ideas. Then the ideas themselves are quite persuasive. And we would want him to be able to influence the people around him. That is to say, it's not... that's not the complete package. There's more to it than what any one of us would want to believe always. But what he says, this is a fellow that's talking about paying attention, doing it, being a thinking man is Freemason. And I think, he's an interesting, interesting fellow because he has a point. But the point isn't for everybody all the time. At least I don't think so. But in a time and a place, I think it's brilliant. It truly is. So I don't want to dismiss it. I think that would be wrong-minded. And I think he influences the thinking because he was because there's a need, there's an appetite for to always put what we're going through in some kind of context, and I think that's what Worshipful Brother Andrew Hammer does for us. It helps put our current experience into a different context. Now, in his case, he's saying that this is we'd all be better off if we leaned toward this type of thinking. And I think he's probably, there's some merit in what it's hard to argue that that wouldn't necessarily be the case. But it's also a form of thinking about the order. Yeah, I'm a bit stodgy about Freemasonry. I think there is a form. I think there's a protocol and a sophistication that is really quite important to our craft.
And, of course, people in some jurisdictions look at us showing up in a business suit or a tuxedo or white tie as, not quite getting it. But for the likes of people like you and I think Grand Lodge provides that. They really are the keystone. Yeah, a little note to Dale. I'll do a little talk on a comparison around the Royal Arch and the Scottish Rite. I think I'll come back to that one. But the keystone that I'm talking about here is that connection between part of the arch from our history, where we build, that's the building side. I look at that as coming from the left going to the right in the arch. And at the top is our Grand Lodge linking us to the future. And I think that's really quite significant. We weren't there. There is more than one way of approaching this. Always more than one way of approaching it. And we have to recognize that that's part of our legacy. That's part of our history. Now, provenance aside, I love that. Who had the oldest, I look at my sense of old, thinking about, is that smell of old leather or wood. If I slide behind the wheel of an old MGB, that just seems like as things age, they got better. A nice glass of, like my good friend John was talking about, a nice glass of red wine with him. It's just the atmosphere. It's wonderful. And my friend Robert, when you're sipping on a single malt, it's the experience with these fellows, It's wonderful just to, it's not just consumption of ideas, and it's really the experience of the encounter. So the Grand Lodge does that for us, I think, time and time again, provides that link between the importance of our past and the exploration of our future. Now we have a lot of other things to do today, don't we? I know I do. I want to, I'm not going to prolong this. I'm still feeling the effects of all the best medicine that I could get lately. But I'd like to part with a notion that things are improving. I hope that when you listen to these ramblings, that they make some sense to you. Hopefully they do. And I want to continue on to visit with you. And in the meantime, I hope you'll take care of each other, commit significant acts of random Masonic kindness, and live well. See you soon. Thanks for joining me.